Scene 3. As we made our first foray into the tragic morass of King Lear, little was clarified. What became painfully clear to me, however, was that we had greatly underestimated the enormousness of Richard's absence. He was more than a vacant bedroom, an unoccupied seat in the library, a chair at our refectory table where he sat like Banquo's ghost, invisible to everyone but us. Often I thought I saw him out of the corner of my eye, a passing shadow, slipping out of sight around the corner. By night he was a recurring character in my dreams, as my midterm scene partner or my silent companion at the bar, twisting the most mundane scenarios into something dark and sinister. I was not the only victim of these nocturnal torments. James had taken to muttering and fidgeting in his sleep, and on the nights I shared a bed with Meredith, sometimes I woke to find her trembling beside me. Twice we were all woken by sounds of screaming and sobbing from Wren's room. He was as much a bully in death as he was in life, a giant who left behind not an empty space so much as a black hole, a huge, crushing void that swallowed up all of our comforts sooner or later. But as we were moving cautiously into the shortest calendrical month, our comfort was mostly my responsibility. Cleaning the castle had become my primary occupation outside of classes, rehearsals, and homework. My custodial schedule was irregular, determined largely by when I had a free hour and nobody else was in the building. These coincidental opportunities were few and far between, and I was forced to seize them whenever they arrived, regardless of how tired I was. The second day of February found me on my hands and knees in the library, finally doing what I had put off for weeks and thoroughly cleaning out the fireplace. The remains of a few logs rested in the grate like a pile of blackened bones. I lifted them delicately for fear they would crumble and leave streaks of soot on the carpet, and deposited them one by one in the paper sack I had appropriated for the purpose. Despite the persistent winter chill, I was sweating, fat, salty beads falling from my forehead onto the hearth. When the logs were all safely stowed in their bag, I reached for a dustpan and brush and started on the pile of ash, which had built up like a mountain against the back of the chimney. As I swept, I muttered Edgar's lines under my breath. "Who alone suffers, suffers most i' the mind, leaving free things and happy shows behind. But then the mind much sufferance doth o'erskip when grief hath mates and bearing fellowship." Unable to remember the following line, I stopped and sat back on my heels. What next? I had no idea, and so crawled further into the fireplace, beginning the speech again as I resumed my sweeping. The densest mound of ash collapsed under my brush, but as I pulled it forward, something dragged beneath the bristles. A long, twisted line like a snakeskin had appeared on the floor of the fireplace. Fabric. It was nothing more than a scrap, 5 inches long and 2 inches wide, curling in at the edges. One end was heavier, double-stitched, a shirt collar maybe, or the seam of a sleeve. I bent my head low over it and blew gently, so a few little puffs of ash whirled up. It had been white once, but it was badly singed and badly stained with something dark, deep red like wine. I stared at it for a moment in consternation, then froze where I was kneeling on the hearth. So horror-struck, I didn't hear the door downstairs. But the footsteps in the stairwell grew louder as they ascended, and I came back to life with a jolt, seized the insidious thing off the floor, and stuffed it into my pocket. I grabbed the dustpan and brush and jumped to my feet with one held at each side, like sword and shield. I was still standing in this rigid, ridiculous way when Colborne appeared in the doorway. His eyes barely widened, quickly adjusted from surprise at my presence to recognition.
"Oliver?"
"Detective Colborne," I said, clumsy and cotton-mouthed. He pointed into the room.
"May I come in?"
"If you want to." He slid his hands into the pockets of his jeans. His badge glinted on one hip, and the butt of a handgun bulged under the hem of his coat on the other. I deposited the brush and pan in the closest chair, waiting for him to speak.
"Aren't you usually in rehearsal this time of day?"
he asked, tugging the curtains apart in order to peer out the window toward the lake. "I'm not called for combat until 5. I rummaged through my mental archives for one of Gwendolyn's breath control routines, hoping to clear my head. He nodded and gave me a quizzical smile.
"And what exactly are you doing, if you don't mind my asking?"
"Cleaning." I counted 4 beats to breathe in. His mouth twitched as if there were a genuine smile hiding under the superficial one.
"I never thought Delacour students the sort who did their own cleaning."
"We don't, usually. I'm on scholarship." 5 beats to breathe out. He chuckled like he couldn't quite believe it.
"So they've got you cleaning this place?"
"Among other things." My pulse began to slow. "I don't mind."
"You're from Ohio, is that right?"
"You've got a good memory. Or have you got a file on me somewhere?"
"Both, maybe."
"Should I be nervous?" I asked, but I felt markedly less so. Colborne was a more discerning audience than I was used to, but an audience nonetheless.
"Well, you'd know that better than I would."
We stared at each other. He still had that 2-layer smile on, and it occurred to me that under any other circumstances, I would have liked him. "Hard not to be nervous when the police are in and out of your house so often," I said without thinking. He didn't know I'd overheard his conversation with Walton a month before. If he noticed my blunder, he didn't let on.
"Fair enough."
He glanced out the window once more, then crossed the room and sat down on the couch in front of me.
"You all read a lot, or are these just for decoration?"
He pointed at the nearest bookshelf. "We read."
"You read anything besides Shakespeare?"
"Sure. Shakespeare doesn't exist in a vacuum."
"How so?"
I couldn't tell if he was truly interested or if it was some kind of ploy. "Well, take Caesar," I said, unsure what sort of incriminating information he might hope to get from the question. "Ostensibly, it's all about the fall of the Roman Republic, but it's also all about the politics of early modern England. In the first scene, the tribunes and the revelers talk about trades and holidays like it's London in 1599, even though it's supposed to be 44 BC. There are a few anachronisms, like the clock in Act 2, but for the most part it works both ways."
"Clever man," Colborne said after a moment's consideration. "You know, I remember reading Caesar in school. They never told us any of that, just dragged us through it. I must have been about 15, and I thought I was being punished for something."
"Anything can feel like punishment if it's taught poorly."
"True. I guess I'm just wondering what makes a kid about that age decide to devote his whole life to Shakespeare."
"Are you asking me?"
"Yeah. I'm intrigued."
"I don't know," I said. It was easier to keep talking than to stop. "I got hooked early. The high school needed a kid for Henry V when I was about 11, so my English teacher took me to the audition. She thought it might make me less shy, I guess. And somehow I wound up on stage with all these boys with swords and armor who were all twice my size. And there I was shouting, 'As young as I am, I have observed these 3 swashers,' just hoping people would hear me. I was terrified until opening night, but after that it was all I wanted to do. It's a kind of addiction." He was silent for a moment, then asked,
"Does it make you happy?"
"Sorry?"
"Does it make you happy?"
I opened my mouth to respond. "Yes," seemed the only possible answer, but then I closed it again, uncertain. I cleared my throat and spoke more cautiously. "I won't pretend it's not difficult. We're always working, and we don't sleep much, and it's hard to have normal friendships outside of our sphere. But it's worth it just for the rush we get, being on stage and speaking Shakespeare's words. It's like we're not really alive until then. And then everything just lights up, and the bad stuff disappears, and we don't want to be anywhere else. He sat inhumanly still, keen gray eyes fixed on mine.
You paint a very good picture of addiction.
I tried to backtrack. It sounds overdramatic, but that's just how we're wired. It's how we feel everything.
Fascinating.
Colborn watched me, his fingers laced between his knees, the pose casual, but every muscle in his body taut with expectation. The ticking of the mantle clock was enormously loud, beating directly against my eardrums. The scrap from the fireplace felt like a ball of lead in my pocket. So, I continued, anxious to change the subject, divert it away from what I had just said. What brings you back down here? He leaned back, more relaxed.
Sometimes I get curious.
About what?
About Richard, he said.
And it was jarring to hear him say it so easily, the name we all avoided like a curse word, something even more profane than the oaths and obscenities we used so liberally.
Don't you?
Mostly I try not to think about it. Colborn's eyes flicked from my feet to my face and back, an evaluative look, measuring the depth of my honesty.
I can't help but wonder what happened that night,
he said, one hand drumming idly on the arm of the sofa.
Everyone seems to remember it differently.
There was a subtle, cloying challenge in his voice. Answer, if you dare. Everyone experienced it differently, I think. My own voice was cool and flat, my nerves settled again by the fact that he'd given me a part to play, and as a casting director he was no more imaginative than Gwendolyn. I was peripheral, a bystander, an unwilling witness who just might be won over. It's like watching the news. When there's a disaster, does anyone really remember it the same way? We all saw it from different angles, different vantage points. He nodded slowly, considering my rebuttal.
I suppose I can't argue with that.
He pushed himself to his feet. When he was upright again, he rocked back on his heels, looked up at the ceiling.
Here's what I struggle with, Oliver,
he said, speaking more to the light fixture than to me.
Mathematically, it doesn't make sense.
I waited for him to elaborate. He didn't, so I said, math was never my strong subject. He frowned, but there was a flicker of amusement in his expression.
Surprising. After all, Shakespeare is poetry, most of it anyway, and there's a certain mathematical pattern to poetry, isn't there?
You could say that.
In any mathematical equation, a series of known and unknown variables add up to the given solution.
That's about what I remember of algebra. Solve for X.
Precisely, he said. Well, here we have an equation with a known outcome, Richard's death. We'll call that X. And on the other side of the equals sign, we have your, that is, the fourth year's accounts of the event. A, B, C, D, E, and F, if you will. And then there's everyone else. We'll call them Y. 9 weeks later, we have all the variables accounted for, but I still can't solve for X. Can't get the two sides of the equation to balance.
He shook his head, the motion measured and deliberate.
So what does that mean?
I stared at him, didn't answer.
It means, he went on, that at least one of our variables is wrong. Makes sense to you?
To a certain extent, but I think the premise is flawed.
How so?
He said, the question wry, almost teasing. I shrugged. You can't quantify humanity. You can't measure it, not the way you mean to. People are passionate and flawed and fallible. They make mistakes. Their memories fade. Their eyes deceive them. I paused just long enough that he might believe I hadn't planned what to say next. or sometimes they drink too much and fall in the lake. Colborne blinked, and a kind of profound confusion surfaced in his expression, as though he wasn't sure whether he might have miscalculated me.
"Is that really how you think it happened?"
"Yes," I said. "Of course it was."
We'd been saying it for weeks.
"Yes, he fell. Of course he did." Colborne sighed, his breath heavy in the lukewarm library air.
"You know, Oliver, I like you. Mostly in spite of myself."
I frowned, unsure if I'd heard him right. "Strange thing to say."
"Well, truth can be stranger than fiction. My point is, I'd like to trust you, but that's a lot to ask, so instead I'm just going to ask a favor."
I realized he was expecting a reply, so I said, "All right."
"I'm guessing you'll get a good look at this place as you clean it," he said. "If you find anything unusual, well, let's just say I wouldn't mind being kept in the loop."
A pause followed, like a scripted beat between lines in a play. "I'll keep that in mind." Colborne's eyes lingered on me a moment longer, and then he walked slowly back across the room to the stairs where he stopped.
"Be careful, Oliver," he said. "As I said, I like you. And let me put this in such a way that you'll be sure to understand. Something is rotten in the state of Denmark."
With that, he left, a small smile on his mouth, at once sad and mocking. I stood motionless as his footsteps creaked on the stairs, and only when I heard the front door close behind him did I unclench my fist in my pocket. The blood-spotted scrap there was crumpled and damp with sweat. Scene 4. I gave Colborne a 5-minute head start because I didn't want him to catch me leaving the castle. I stashed my cleaning supplies under the kitchen sink, pulled my coat and gloves on, and left through the back door. I ran the whole distance to the fab without stopping, frost crunching under my feet. By the time I arrived, my limbs were numb, my eyes watering from the sting of the sharp February air. I let myself in through a side door and listened carefully. The third years were in the auditorium, stumbling through the second act of Two Gentlemen of Verona. Hoping not to run into anyone loitering backstage, I hurried into the stairwell, one hand skating along the railing as I took the steep steps to the basement two at a time. A sprawling undercroft lurked beneath the Archibald Delacour Theater and all of its tributary hallways and anterooms. Usually, only the technical crew ventured into that low-ceilinged, dimly lit warren to unearth old props and furniture long ago deemed irrelevant and doomed to eternal storage. I hadn't planned to go there, hadn't even thought of it until I was halfway to the fab, desperate at first just to get the hell away from the castle. But as I crept down two or three shadowy corridors crowded with theatrical refuse, I realized my own accidental brilliance. Nobody could ever find anything in the undercroft, even if they knew exactly what they were looking for. Before long, I stumbled into a cobwebbed corner where a bank of lockers, probably ripped out of the crossover sometime in the 80s, leaned tiredly against the wall. Rust leaked from their gills like old dried blood and crept across their gaping, sharp-edged doors. It was as good a place as any. I shoved a battered trestle table out of my way, then waded through the rubbish piled up in my path. The first locker had a padlock hanging on the door, the catch spotted with rust like a bad tooth. I removed it, pulled hard on the handle, and swore as loudly as I dared when the door sprang open and cracked against my shin. The locker was empty except for a chipped mug bearing a faded Delacour coat of arms, a black ring of coffee clinging to the bottom. I reached into my pocket to find the scrap of fabric I'd plucked from the fireplace. I squinted at it in the dim light, and that ominous red stain glared back. I wasn't even sure it was blood, but my own paranoia dragged me back to the day of Richard's memorial service when I'd found Philippa alone by the fireplace. I thrust the thought away with alarm. There were no locks on the library doors, so it might have been any one of us.
The air in the undercroft felt frigid. Any one of us might have done what? Suddenly nauseous and impatient to get the thing out of sight, I bent down and stuffed it into the mug. If anyone else found it there, they'd just think it a rag, stained with paint or dye or some other innocuous thing. For all I knew, it was. I chastised myself for being excitable. Alexander was right about that much. If we didn't keep our wits about us, everything would come undone. I slammed the door, then hesitated. I didn't know the lock's combination. I didn't want to return to it ever, but just in case, I left it dangling, open. I shoved the trestle table back in front of the lockers, hoping that maybe nobody else would bother moving it, that nobody would even know I'd been there. I stepped back and stood staring at the small wheel of the lock, the tiny gap between the shackle and case. How tremendous the agony of unmade decisions. Scene 5. I got lost on my way out of the basement and was late for combat call. James, Camilo, and 3 second years were already there.
Sorry, I said. Sorry, I lost track of the time.
Where have you been? James asked, with a strange deadpan expression. I was burning to ask him the same question, but not in front of other people. Camilo interjected,
Let's talk later. We've got a lot to get through and not a whole lot of time to do it. Did you two work this over the weekend?
I glanced at James, who said yes before I could answer. We'd only run through the blocking twice because he'd been out of the castle most of the day Saturday and all day Sunday.
Then let's get started, Camilo said. Shall we go from Edgar's challenge?
The set for Lear had been outlined on the floor in blue spike tape. It was a curious design, the proscenium stage stretching into a catwalk that ran down the center aisle of the audience. We called it the bridge. The elevation was marked at 4 feet. I took my place upstage, my rapier hanging on my left hip. James and the rest of them were already in place, he at the top of the bridge, the soldiers on stage left, Camilo and the herald on stage right. Meredith should have been there too, but there was no sense summoning her when all she did was watch.
Me. What's he that speaks for Edmund, Earl of Gloucester?
James.
Himself. What sayest thou to him?
I glared at him, fists clenched against the churning of my stomach. There was no need to impress anyone with emotions for a fight call, but I was already on edge.
Me. Draw thy sword, that if my speech offend a noble heart, thy arm may do thee justice. Here is mine.
I drew my sword, and James raised his eyebrows, faintly amused. I crossed downstage to the top of the bridge.
Me. Despite thy victor sword and fire new fortune, thy valor and thy heart, thou art a traitor, false to thy gods, thy brother, and thy father, conspirant against this high illustrious prince, and from the extremest upward of thy head to the descent and dust below thy foot, a most toad-spotted traitor.
Somewhere in the middle of my speech, James's wry amusement faded from his face and was replaced with a cold, ugly look. When it was his turn to speak, I watched him closely, uncertain whether he was acting only or if he and I both were gnashing secrets between our teeth.
James. What safe and nicely I might well delay by rule of knighthood, I disdain and spurn. Back do I toss those treasons to thy head.
He may as well have spat at me.
James. With the hell-hated lie o'erwhelm thy heart, which, for they yet glance by and scarcely bruise, this sword of mine shall give them instant way where they shall rest forever. Trumpets, speak!
We raised our weapons, bowed to each other without breaking eye contact. He attacked first. My block was sloppy, and his blade slid along mine to the hilt with an angry hiss. I threw him off and clumsily recovered my balance. Another blow, another block. I parried, struck at his left shoulder. The foils clattered together, their blunt edges colliding with the rattle and snap of a snare drum.
"Easy," Camilo said. "Easy now."
We danced a rapid grapevine down a narrow aisle between two long lines of tape. That was the choreography. I beat him to the end of the bridge, where he would fall, one hand on his stomach, blood blossoming beneath his fingers. How this would happen, we had yet to be informed by the costume crew. We fought with our bodies parallel, swords flashing between us. He staggered, lost his footing, but when I raised my arm to deliver the killing stroke, his fingers curled more tightly around the hilt of his sword. The pommel and guard cracked across my face, white-hot stars burst through my field of vision, and pain hit me like a battering ram. Camilo and one of the soldiers shouted at the same time. The rapier slipped loose from my fingers and crashed down beside me as I fell backward onto my elbows, blood gushing from my nose like someone had turned on a faucet. James dropped his foil and gaped down at me with wide, bulging eyes.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?" Camilo yelled.
James stepped back like a sleepwalker, slowly, entranced. His fingers flexed at his side, his knuckles gleaming red. I tried to speak, but my mouth was full of iron, blood dribbling down my chin, soaking the front of my shirt. The two soldiers propped me up and my head drooped heavily forward, like all the tendons in my neck had snapped. Camilo was still shouting,
"Unacceptable! What the hell's gotten into you?"
James looked up at him instead of me.
He began.
"Get out," Camilo said. "I'll deal with you later."
James's mouth moved wordlessly. Water suddenly welled in his eyes, and he turned and ran out of the room, leaving his coat and gloves and everything else behind.
"Oliver, are you all right?"
Camilo crouched beside me, lifting my chin.
"You got all your teeth?"
I closed my lips, swallowed blood, and gulped hard against the reflex to vomit. He pointed first at the taller of the two soldiers, then at the other one.
"You, help me get him to the infirmary. You, run and find Frederick. Tell him I need to see him and Gwendolyn immediately. Move!"
The world reeled as they hoisted me up, and I hoped dully that I'd lose consciousness and never wake up again. Scene 6. I didn't get out of the infirmary until after 11. My nose was broken, but not badly. A splint had been taped over the bridge to keep it straight, and beneath that, red and purple bruises were spreading under both my eyes. Gwendolyn and Frederick had been to see me, asked what happened, apologized profusely, and then requested that I keep it as much to myself as possible and call it an accident if other students asked. We didn't, they said, need any more gossip or any more trouble. By the time I got back to the castle, I hadn't decided whether I would comply or not. I went immediately upstairs, but not to the tower. It seemed unlikely that James would be there, but I didn't want to risk it. Instead, I knocked softly on Alexander's door. I heard a drawer scrape shut, and a moment later he appeared, one hand on the doorknob.
"Fuck, Oliver," he said. "Pip told me what happened, but I didn't think it'd be this bad."
His eyes were bloodshot, his lips dry and cracked. He didn't look much better than I did.
"I don't really want to talk about it."
"Fair enough." He sniffed, wiped his nose on his sleeve. "Can I help?" "My head hurts like a bitch, and right now I'd rather not feel anything above the neck." He opened the door wider.
"The doctor is in."
I didn't go in Alexander's room often, and I was always surprised by how dark it was. Sometime in the last few weeks, he'd tacked a tapestry over the window. His bed was buried under a pile of books, which he gathered up and dropped on the already cluttered desk. Crumpled rolling papers, broken matches, and dirty clothes littered the floor.
He gestured at the bed, and I sank gratefully down on the mattress, my pulse pounding hard between my temples.
"Can I ask what happened?" he said as he rummaged in the top drawer of his desk.
"I won't make you talk about it. I just want to know whether I should shove James in the lake next time I see him."
Unsure if the remark was simply Alexander's morbid sense of humor or something more deliberate, I shifted on the bed, chalked it up to lingering paranoia, and decided to ignore it.
"Have you seen much of him lately?" I asked. "I feel like he's never here."
"He comes in and out. You'd know better than I would."
"He usually comes in after I've gone to bed, and by the time I get up, he's gone."
Alexander shook a few little florets of weed out of a film canister and crumbled them into a cigarette paper. "If you ask me, he's getting a little too deep into his role. Method, you know. Doesn't know where he stops and Edmund starts anymore."
"Well, that can't be good."
He looked up at me and my busted nose.
"Clearly."
He made a face like he'd just bitten his tongue.
"Did they give you some kind of painkillers for that?"
I produced a bottle of little white pills from my pocket.
"Grand," he said. "Give me two of those."
I handed them over. He crushed both under the film canister and sprinkled the resulting powder on top of the weed in the paper. Then he reached into the drawer again, came up with another mysterious pill bottle. He popped the top off, tapped it on the heel of his palm. Another white powder, finer. He added this to the joint without telling me what it was. I didn't ask.
"So what happened?" he said as he started rolling. "You guys were doing the 5-3 combat and he just clocked you?"
"Basically."
"What the fuck? Why?"
"Believe me, I'd love to know." He ran his tongue along the sticky edge of the paper, then pasted it down with one fingertip. He twisted the end into a tiny curl and handed the joint to me.
"There," he said. "Smoke that in one go and you won't feel anything for a week."
"Terrific." I stood and grabbed onto the back of his chair. My head was throbbing.
"You all right?"
"I will be in a few minutes."
He didn't sound convinced.
"You sure?"
"Yeah," I said. "I'll be fine."
I felt my way to the door like a blind man, hands moving from one piece of furniture to the next until I reached the wall.
"Oliver," he said as I opened the door to let myself out.
"Yeah?"
He tossed me a lighter when I turned, then pointed at his nose and smiled sadly. I reached up to my face. There was a fresh spot of blood on my upper lip.
As a rule, we didn't smoke in the castle. I exited through the side door and stood in the driveway with the joint, spliff, whatever it was, pinched tightly between my lips. I inhaled how Alexander had taught me 2 years before, deep into the lungs. It was cold, even for February, and my breath and the smoke came out of my mouth together in one long spiral. My sinuses felt heavy and thick, like they'd been plugged up with clay. I wondered when the bruises would fade, if my nose would look the same in 3 weeks' time. I leaned against the wall and tried not to think anymore, certain I'd drive myself crazy if I did. The forest was quiet and, at the same time, brimming with small sounds. The distant hoot of an owl, the dry rustle of leaves, a breeze slithering through the treetops. Somehow, slowly, my brain disconnected from the rest of me. I still felt pain, still twisted in the grip of indecision, but there was something between me and thought and feeling and everything else. A fine mist, a backlit scrim, shadow puppet silhouettes moving softly on the other side. Whether it was the cold or Alexander's joint, I couldn't say, but inch by inch, I began to go numb. The door opened, closed. I looked toward it without expectation or curiosity.
Meredith.
She hesitated on the porch for a moment, then came down. I didn't move.
She took the joint out of my mouth, threw it on the ground, and kissed me before I could speak. A dull throb of pain went up the bridge of my nose to my brain. Her palm was warm on the side of my face, her mouth magnetic. She took my hand like she had so many weeks ago and led me back inside. Scene 7. I slept through most of the following day, regaining consciousness for only a moment or two when Meredith slid out of bed, brushed my hair back off my forehead, and left for class. I murmured something at her, but the words never really took shape. Sleep crawled back on top of me like an affectionate, purring pet, and I didn't wake again for 8 hours. When I did, Philippa was sitting cross-legged on the bed beside me. I gazed up at her blearily, groping through my muddled memory of the previous night, unsure I had any clothes on under the blanket. She pushed me back down when I tried to sit up.
"How do you feel?" she asked.
"How do I look?"
"Honestly? Awful."
"Coincidence? No."
"What time is it?"
The windows were already dark.
9:15, she said, and her forehead creased. "Have you slept all day?"
I groaned, shifted, reluctant to lift my head. "Mostly." "How was class?"
"Very quiet."
"Why?"
"Well, without you, there were only 4 of us."
"Who else was missing?"
"Who do you think?"
I turned my head away from her on the pillow, stared hard at the wall. The movement produced a painful thud in my sinus cavity that distracted me, but only for a moment. "I suppose you're waiting for me to ask where he is," I said. She plucked at the edge of the comforter where it was folded across my chest.
"Nobody's seen him since yesterday. After fight call, he just disappeared."
I grunted at her and said, "There's a but. I can hear it coming." She sighed, her shoulders rising slightly up and sinking down much farther.
"But he's back now. He's up in the tower."
"In which case, I will be staying right here until Meredith kicks me out." Her mouth made a flat pink line. Behind her glasses, I didn't know why she was wearing them, she wasn't reading anything, her eyes were drowsy ocean blue, patient but tired.
"Come on, Oliver," she said quietly. "It can't hurt to go up and talk to him."
I gestured at my face. Apparently it can.
"Look, we're all mad at him, too. I think Meredith left a scorch mark on the floor where she was standing when he came in. Even Wren wouldn't talk to him."
"Good," I said.
"Oliver."
"What?" She leaned her cheek on one hand and inexplicably, grudgingly smiled.
"What?" I said again, more warily. "You," she said. "You know I wouldn't even be in here if you were anyone else."
"What does that mean?"
"It means that you have better reasons than the rest of us to hold a grudge, but you're also the first one who's going to forgive him."
The unsettling feeling that Philippa could see right through my skin made me squirm deeper into the mattress.
"Is that so?"
I said, but it sounded weak and unpersuasive even to me.
"Yeah."
Her smile faded.
"We can't afford to be at one another's throats right now. Things are bad enough." She seemed frail all of a sudden. Thin and transparent, like a cancer patient. Unflappable Philippa.
I felt a weird, overwhelming urge to just hold her, ashamed that I had, however briefly, suspected her of anything. I wanted to pull her under the blanket and wrap my arms around her. I almost did it before I remembered that I probably wasn't dressed.
"Fine," I said. "I'll go talk to him."
She nodded, and I thought I saw the flash of a tear behind her glasses.
"Thanks."
She waited a moment, realized I wasn't moving, and said,
Okay, when?
In a minute. She blinked, and all traces of the tear, if it had ever been there, were gone.
Are you naked?
She said. I might be. She left the room. I took my time getting dressed. As I climbed the stairs to the tower, I found myself walking in slow motion. It didn't feel like I was going up to see James for the first time in only a day or two. I felt like I hadn't really seen him, spoken to him, communicated with him in any significant way since before Christmas. The door at the top of the stairs was cracked. I nervously licked my lip and pushed it open. He was perched on the side of the bed, eyes fixed on the floor, but it wasn't his bed. It was mine. Comfortable? I said. He stood swiftly and took two steps forward. Oliver. I raised one hand, palm out, like a crossing guard. No. Just stay over there for a minute. He stopped in the middle of the room.
Okay. Whatever you want.
My feet were unsteady on the floorboards. I swallowed, choked down a surge of strange, despondent affection. I want to forgive you, I blurted. But James, I could kill you right now, honestly. I reached toward him, clenched my fist on empty air. I want to... God, I can't even explain it. You're like a bird, you know that? He opened his mouth, a question, some expression of confusion caught on the tip of his tongue. I made a harsh, inelegant gesture, a chop of the hand to keep him from speaking. My thoughts tumbled out manic and disorganized. Alexander was right. Richard's not the sparrow. It's you. You're, I don't know, this fragile, elusive thing, and I feel like if I could just catch you, I could crush you. He had this terrible, wounded look on his face, and he had no right to it. Not in that moment. Half a dozen conflicting feelings roared up in me at once, and I took a huge, ungainly step toward him. I want so badly to be so mad at you that I could do that, but I can't, so I'm mad at myself instead. Do you even understand how unfair that is? My voice was high and stringent like a little boy's. I hated it, so I swore loudly. Fuck! Fuck this! Fuck me! Fuck you! God damn it, James! I wanted to throw him to the floor, fight him down, and do what? The violence of the thought alarmed me, and with a strangled noise of outrage, I seized a book off the trunk at the end of his bed and flung it at him, threw it at his knees. It was a paperback copy of Lear, limp and harmless, but he winced as it hit him. It fluttered to the floor at his feet, one page hanging crookedly out from the binding. When he looked up at me, I averted my eyes immediately.
Oliver, I don't!
I jabbed a finger at him for silence.
Don't. Just let me... Just... For a minute.
I dragged my fingers through my hair. A hard ball of pain had lodged behind the bridge of my nose, and my eyes were beginning to water.
What is it about you?
I asked, my words thick from the effort of keeping my voice steady. I glared at him, waiting for an answer I knew I wouldn't get.
I should hate you right now, and I want to. God, I want to. But that's not enough.
I shook my head, utterly at a loss. What on earth was happening to us? I searched his face for a hint of it, some clue to seize on, but for a long time all he did was breathe. With his face twisted up like breathing hurt.
My name, dear saint, is hateful to myself, he said, because it is an enemy to thee.
I recognized the text, the balcony scene. Too mistrustful to guess at the meaning, I said, Don't do that, James, please. Right now, can we just be ourselves? He crouched down, lifted the mangled script from the floor.
I'm sorry, he said.
It's easier now to be Romeo or Macbeth or Brutus or Edmund. Someone else.
James, I said again more gently, are you all right?
He shook his head, eyes downcast. His voice crept out of his mouth with fearful, cautious steps.
No, I'm not.
Okay. I shifted my weight foot to foot. The floor still didn't feel firm enough.
Can you tell me what's wrong?
Oh, he said with a strange, watery smile.
No. Everything.
I'm sorry, I said, and it sounded like a question. He moved forward one step, closed the small space between us, and lifted his hand, touched the bruise that had spread beneath my left eye. A sliver of pain. I twitched.
I should be the sorry one, he said.
My eyes flicked from one of his to the other, gray like steel, gold like honey.
I don't know what made me do it. I've never wanted to hurt you before.
His fingertips felt like ice. But now, I said.
Why?
His arm fell lifelessly to his side. He looked away and said,
Oliver, I don't know what's wrong with me. I want to hurt the whole world.
James. I took his arm, turned him back toward me. Before I could decide what to do next, I felt his hand on my chest and glanced down. His palm was pressed against my shirt, his fingers splayed across my collarbone. I waited for him to pull me closer or push me away. But he only stared at his hand, like it was something strange he'd never seen before.
Scene 8. February didn't linger long. The middle of the month had come and gone before I'd even stopped writing January on all my papers by mistake. Our midterm performance exams were approaching fast, and though Frederick and Gwendolyn had been unusually kind in their scene assignments, we were fighting to stay afloat in a sea of lines to learn, reading to do, text to scan, and papers to hand in. Early one Sunday evening, James and I and the girls huddled in the library, running lines for the scenes we were scheduled to perform in class the following week. James and Philippa had Hamlet and Gertrude. Meredith and Wren were reading Emilia and Desdemona. I was waiting for Alexander to show up and read Arcita to my Palamon.
Honestly, Philippa said as she tripped over the same line for the fourth time, would it have killed them to make me Ophelia? I am not by any stretch of the imagination old enough to be your mother.
Would it were not so, James said.
She sighed enormously.
What have I done that thou darest wag thy tongue in noise so rude against me?
Such an act that blurs the grace and blush of modesty.
They continued to argue quietly. I leaned back on the couch, watched Meredith brush Wren's hair for a moment. They made a pretty picture, the firelight playing softly on their faces, gleaming on the curves of lips and eyelashes. Wren,
wouldst thou do such a deed for all the world?
Meredith,
the world's a huge thing. It is a great price for a small vice.
Wren,
in troth, I think thou wouldst not.
I lifted my own notebook again. My text was slashed through and underlined in four different colors, so chaotically annotated that it was difficult to find the original words. I muttered to myself for a while, the others' voices drifting gently on the whisper and crack of the fire. 15 minutes ticked by, then 20. I was beginning to grow restless when the door opened downstairs. I sat up straighter. Finally, footsteps came quickly up the stairs, and I said, "It's about time. I've been waiting on you all night," before I realized that it wasn't Alexander.
"Colin,"
Wren said, breaking out of her scene.
He nodded, hands moving uneasily in his coat pockets.
Sorry to barge in.
What's up? I asked.
I'm looking for Alexander.
His cheeks were pink, but I doubted it had much to do with the cold. Philippa exchanged a fast glance with Meredith, who said,
We thought he was with you.
Colin nodded, eyes darting around the room, strategically avoiding all of our faces. Yeah, he said he'd meet me for a drink at 5, but I haven't seen him or heard anything. He shrugged. Starting to worry, you know?
Yeah.
Philippa was already climbing out of her chair. Does someone want to check his room? I'll look in the kitchen, see if he left a note.
I'll go.
Colin nearly ran out of the library, clearly desperate to get to the hall where we wouldn't all be staring at him. Meredith.
What do you suppose that's about?
Me.
Don't know.
Did he say anything to any of you?
Ren.
No, but he's been a bit odd lately.
James. Haven't we all?
Ren frowned at me. I had nothing to add, so I shrugged. She opened her mouth, but to say what, I never found out, because Colin came thundering in again, all the rosy color gone from his face.
He's in his room. Something's wrong. Something's really wrong.
His voice cracked on the last word, and we were all on our feet at once. Philippa's voice chased us down the hall from the kitchen, high and nervous, calling,
Guys, what's going on?
The door cracked hard against the wall as Colin flung it open. Books and clothes and crumpled papers were strewn around the room like the refuse of a bomb blast. Alexander lay stretched on the floor, his limbs bent at awkward angles, head thrown back as if his neck had been broken.
Oh my God, I said. What do we do?
James shoved past me.
Get out of the way. Colin, prop him up, can you?
Ren pointed across the room.
What is all that?
Under the bed, the floor was littered with pill bottles and film canisters, pushed almost out of sight behind a low-hanging corner of his comforter. Prescription labels had been torn off some, leaving streaks of fuzzy white paper behind. James knelt beside Alexander, squeezing his wrist in search of a pulse. Colin lifted his head off the floor, and some small sound escaped between his lips.
He's alive, I said. He must be. He just...
James's voice was thin and strained.
Shut up a minute! I can't...
Philippa arrived behind us in the doorway.
What's happening?
Alexander murmured something, and Colin bent his head low over his face.
I don't know, I said. He must have taken too much of something. Oh, God! What? What was he on? Does anyone know?
His pulse is really erratic, James said, talking fast and low. He's got to go to the hospital. Someone get downstairs and call for an ambulance, and someone gather up all of that shit.
He pointed at the pill bottles under the bed. Colin blanched, cradling Alexander's sweaty head in his lap.
You can't send that stuff to the hospital. Do you want him to get expelled?
Would you rather he died?
James said fiercely. Before Colin could answer, Alexander's whole body seized up, teeth clenched, muscles twitching.
Do what he says, Meredith ordered. Somebody get to the phone now!
She crouched down beside James and started sweeping bottles out from under the bed. Alexander moaned, one hand groping across the floor. Colin grabbed it and squeezed hard, rocking slightly forward. Ren had backed into a corner and crouched there, hugging herself, looking sick. My stomach tried to crawl out of my mouth. Philippa grabbed my arm.
Oliver, can you...
Yeah, I'll go. You look after Ren.
I left the room and flew down the stairs, my feet numb and clumsy underneath me. I grabbed the phone out of its cradle and dialed 911. A voice answered. Female. Indifferent. Efficient.
911, what's your emergency?
I'm at the castle on the Delacour school grounds, and we need an ambulance immediately.
What is the nature of your emergency?
She was so cool, so calm. I fought an urge to shout at her.
Emergency, does it mean nothing to you?
some kind of drug overdose. I don't know. Get help here now.
I dropped the phone, letting it fall out of my hand, pulled the cord taut with a jerk, and swing like a dead man on the end of a rope. As I listened to the tinny voice droning from the phone, the distant sounds of dismay and agitation from upstairs, all I could think was, why? Why the drugs? Why the overdose? What has he done? What has he done? What has he done? I couldn't go back up, but I couldn't stay where I was, terrified of what I might say when the police or paramedics wanted answers. I left the phone dangling and threw the door open without taking my coat, scarf, gloves, anything. I gained momentum as I walked down the driveway, the gravel like little chunks of ice under my socks. By the time I hit the dirt, buried under a muddled blanket of old snow and pine needles, I was running full tilt. My heart pumped hard against the cold, and blood slammed through my veins, thundered and roared in my ears until the dam in my sinus cavity burst and it came streaming out of my nose again. I ran straight into the trees, where branches and thorns tore at my face and arms and legs, but I barely felt them, tiny pricks of pain lost in the tumult and snarl of panic. I turned off the path and plunged deeper into the woods, so deep I didn't know if I'd be able to find my way back, deep enough that no one would hear me. When I thought my heart or my lungs would burst, I fell on my hands and knees in the icy leaves and howled into the trees until something in my throat broke. Scene 9. There were only four of us in class on Tuesday morning: James, Philippa, Meredith, and me. Alexander hadn't yet come back from Broadwater's emergency clinic, though he was stable by then, or so we'd been told. The rest of us were pulled from class one by one on Monday to undergo psychiatric evaluation. The school shrink and a doctor from Broadwater took turns asking us invasive questions about ourselves, one another, and our collectively bad track record with substance abuse. We each left with a pamphlet on the dangers of drug use and a stern reminder that attendance of the upcoming alcohol awareness seminar was mandatory. Beyond the obvious problems of stress and exhaustion, both James and Wren, from what I'd overheard outside Hollinshed's office on my way to the bathroom, were exhibiting symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. She'd taken an additional day off class to rest, but when I suggested that James do the same, he said, "If I'm shut up in the castle by myself all day, I'll lose my mind." I didn't argue with that, but as it turned out, he wasn't much better off in Studio 5. "Well," Gwendolyn said as soon as we sat down, "I don't think anyone's up for new material today, and besides, there aren't enough of you. I'd be teaching the same lesson tomorrow." Her solution was to work problem scenes from Lear that couldn't be more thoroughly dissected during rehearsal for the sake of time. James and I watched for an hour while Gwendolyn dug her nails into Meredith and Philippa, searching for sparks of real-life sibling rivalry to fan into a flame for the stage. She had her work cut out for her. Meredith barely knew her own brothers, and Philippa claimed not to have any siblings. I still don't know whether this is true. Gwendolyn startled me out of a stupor by asking about my sisters, a subject I was not then nor ever had been fond of. She stopped just short of outing me as the castle's new custodian and mercifully moved on. When she'd hassled the girls to distraction, she gave us a 5-minute water break and instructed James and Meredith to come back prepared for Act 4, Scene 2. When we returned, Gwendolyn opened the scene work with a lecture on last week's lackluster performance. "I mean, really," she said. "This is one of the most passionate moments of the play, between two of the most powerful people in it. The stakes are as high as they can be, so I don't want to feel like I'm watching a bad pickup at the bar." Meredith and James listened without comment, and when she finished, took their places without so much as acknowledging each other. After James had broken my nose, Meredith's attitude toward him went from lukewarm to icy, which undoubtedly contributed to their complete lack of chemistry on stage.
Philippa fed them a cue line. It wasn't hers, but Gwendolyn couldn't be bothered, and they went through the motions with a woodenness that made me cringe. Their words fell flat. Their touches were forced and awkward. Beside me, Philippa watched the scene collapse with a grim, pained expression like she was being tortured.
"Stop, stop, stop,"
Gwendolyn said, waving one hand at James and Meredith.
"Stop."
They moved gratefully apart, like magnets with the same polarity. Meredith folded her arms. James scowled at the floor. Gwendolyn glanced from one of them to the other and said, "What on earth is the matter with you two?" Meredith stiffened. James sensed it and tensed to match, but didn't look at her. Gwendolyn put her hands on her hips and studied them shrewdly. "I'll get to the bottom of it, whatever it is," she said. "But let's talk about the scene first. What's happening here? Meredith?"
"Goneril needs Edmund's help, so she bribes him the only way she knows how."
She sounded utterly bored by it.
"Sure," Gwendolyn said. "That's a fine answer, if you're dead from the neck down. James, let's hear from you. What's happening with Edmund?"
"He sees another way to get what he wants, and he plays the hand she gives him," he said in a toneless, automatic sort of way.
"That's interesting. It's also bullshit," Gwendolyn said, and I looked up from my knees in surprise. "Something huge is missing from this scene, and it's staring you in the face," she went on. "Goneril's not going to kill her husband just so she can have a new captain in the field, and Edmund's not going to risk losing Regan's title unless there's a more compelling offer on the table. So why do they do this?"
Nobody spoke. Gwendolyn whirled around and said, "Oh, for God's sake, Oliver!" so loudly that I jumped.
"I know you know. Murder's as near to what as flame to smoke."
The old familiar line from Pericles shot through my head. "Lust?" I said, wary of the word, as afraid of being right as I was of being wrong.
"Lust!" she barked, and shook her fist at James and Meredith. "Passion! If you just play the logic and not the feelings, the scene doesn't work."
She waved at the two of them again.
"Clearly you two don't feel it, so we're going to have to fix that."
"How?"
"First, we stand facing each other."
She took James by the shoulders and turned him sharply so he and Meredith were almost nose to nose. "Now, we dispense with all the he-she nonsense and start talking like real people. Stop saying Edmund like he's some guy you met at a party. It's not about him, it's about you."
They were both watching her blankly. "No," she said. "No, don't look at me."
They turned and glowered at each other until she added, "It's not a staring contest."
"This isn't working," Meredith snapped.
"And why not?" Gwendolyn said. "You two don't like each other right now? That's too damn bad." She stopped, sighed.
"Here's the thing, kids, and I know this because I've lived a long and scandalous life. Here's the thing about lust. You don't have to like each other. Ever heard of hate sex?"
Philippa made a small gagging noise, and I swallowed a nervous laugh.
"Keep looking at each other, but stop me if I'm wrong," Gwendolyn continued. "James, you don't like Meredith."
"Why not?"
"She's beautiful. She's intelligent. She's fiery. I think she intimidates you, and you don't like to be intimidated. But there's more than that, isn't there?"
She began to walk a slow circle around the pair of them, like a prowling jungle cat.
"You look at her like she disgusts you, but I don't think that's it. I think she distracts you like she distracts every other man with a pulse. When you look at her, you can't help having filthy, sexy thoughts, and then you're disgusted with yourself."
James's hands curled into fists at his sides. I could see how carefully he was breathing,
his chest rising and falling in perfect clockwork time.
"And then there's Miss Meredith," Gwendolyn purred. "You're not afraid to get filthy and sexy, so what is it? You're used to everyone you walk past looking at you like you're a goddess, and I think you're offended by the fact that James resists you. He's the only boy here you can't have. How badly does that make you want him?"
Unlike James, Meredith seemed not to be breathing at all. She stood perfectly still, lips barely parted, a vivid dart of pink on each cheek. I knew that look. It was the same reckless, burning look she'd given me in the stairwell during the Caesar party. Something squirmed under my lungs.
"Now," Gwendolyn instructed, "for once I want you to forget about eye contact and look at every other inch of each other. Do it. Don't rush."
They obeyed. They looked at each other, stared, indulged, and I followed their eyes, saw what they saw. The line of James's jaw, the triangle of smooth skin visible in the V of his collar, the backs of his hands, the delicate bones, precise as lines carved by Michelangelo. And Meredith, the soft clamshell pink of her mouth, the curve of her throat, the slope of her shoulders, the tiny mark I'd left with my teeth on the heel of her palm. Anxiety flickered through every nerve in my body.
"Now look each other in the eyes," Gwendolyn said, "and do this like you mean it. Philippa?"
Philippa glanced down at the script in her hand and said Oswald's last line.
"What most he should dislike seems pleasant to him. What like? Offensive."
Meredith inhaled in a rush, like someone waking up. Her hand landed on James's chest before he could move, held him at arm's length.
"Meredith, then shall you go no further? It is the cowish terror of his spirit that dares not undertake. He'll not feel wrongs which tie him to an answer. Our wishes on the way may prove effects."
She toyed with the collar of his shirt, perhaps distracted by the warmth underneath the fabric. He reached up to find her wrist, traced the blue lace veins there with his fingertips.
"Meredith, back Edmund to my brother. Hasten his musters and conduct his pars. I must change arms at home and give the distaff into my husband's hands."
He watched her mouth as she spoke, and she let her arm bend at the elbow, inviting him closer, as if she'd forgotten why he ought to be kept at a distance.
"Meredith, this trusty servant shall pass between us. Ere long you are like to hear, if you dare venture in your own behalf, a mistress's command."
Her hand moved toward the neck of her sweater, and his moved with it, hovering a hair's breadth from her skin as she found her handkerchief and drew it out.
"Wear this," she said. "Spare speech. Decline your head."
In one sudden motion, he snatched the handkerchief and kissed her so hard he nearly knocked her over. She seized his shirt in both fists like she wanted to choke him, and I heard the hitch in his breath, the little answering gasp. It was violent, aggressive, the handkerchief and its delicate seduction crushed and forgotten. If they'd had claws, they would have mauled each other. I felt hot, sick, lightheaded. I wanted to look away, but couldn't. It was like watching a car crash. I clenched my teeth so hard my vision started to swim. Meredith broke loose, thrust James back a step. They stood 4 feet apart, staring at each other, disheveled and breathless.
"Meredith, this kiss, if it durst speak, would stretch thy spirits up into the air. Conceive and fare thee well."
"James,
yours in the ranks of death."
He turned, exited the wrong way, walked right out of the room. As soon as he was gone, Meredith turned away from the place where he'd stood, and her words were sharp and furious as she said,
"Oh, the difference of man and man! To thee a woman's services are due. My fool usurps my body."
The bell rang, not a moment too soon. I bolted for the hall, skin crawling with the hideous feeling of all their eyes on me.